said Wells and the robber barons, straight to hell, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we have four topics we're going to address. One, the past few days deal apparently reached between Trump and the European Union. It's President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, came to Washington, and they struck a deal with Trump. So let's look at that deal, and in relationship to Trump's general trade offensive and the stalling of negotiations with China and the relationship of it all to NAFTA as well. So we're going to talk about the Trump-Juncker trade deal, which is a misnomer, hardly a deal, but let's hold. We'll get to that first. Then I want to talk about the U.S. GDP numbers, the likelihood of another more than 3% GDP figure here, or GDP result in coming up in the third quarter following the second quarter. What does all this mean, this GDP, U.S. GDP numbers? Are they short-term, long-term? Are they phony? Whatever. Let's talk about U.S. GDP numbers. Then I also want to talk about the debate going on about the federal funds rate hike by the central bank, the Federal Reserve. As we know, Fed rates are going up rapidly. And, of course, since the Fed, Federal Reserve, federal funds rate is the benchmark rate. It's driving up rates and bond rates everywhere. What does all this mean? Is it good? Is it not good? Well, there's a debate among economists now, mainstream economists, some saying, oh, this is not necessary and it's dangerous. We'll slow the economy next year. And others say, no, no, we need the rate increases because we clearly got bubbles in stocks and real estate, and they're going to bust soon. And the Fed needs to get itself a cushion, you see. It needs to raise the rates so that when the recession comes, it can lower rates to stimulate the economy. So that's the debate that's going on. Well, we'll jump into this debate and analyze it and give our own views here. So, you know, we'll start with the Trump-Juncker trade deal. We'll talk about the U.S. GDP numbers, and we'll talk about this debate on the Federal Reserve rate hikes. And if we have time, I want to get to a topic I've just written on, which will appear on my blog shortly, jackrasmus.com, and in other blogs that I write for, and that is, will the trade war precipitate a currency war? And what do we mean by those two? What's the relationship between currency devaluations and the trade, the tariff war here? Is it really a tariff war? You know my view on that. But we'll distinguish between negotiations with NAFTA in Europe and, of course, negotiations with China. All right, so let's jump right into this thing here. Let's talk about this deal that's being hyped in the media, both in the U.S. and Europe, about Trump backing off of his threat to impose tariffs on European auto parts imports to the U.S. All right, Trump, as he's so typically done so many times, he threatens, he comes out with these extreme announcements regarding tariffs. He loves tariffs. He says tariffs are great. He loves tariffs. He comes out with these, extreme threats about tariffs, which shakes up his adversaries who aren't used to this, trading partners, U.S. trading partners, forces them to the negotiating table, and he extracts from them real concessions in exchange for backing off of his mere threats. You see, you got to distinguish, if you're going to talk about a trade war, between trade threats that I'm going to impose tariffs, which Trump does a lot, from announcements of actual tariffs, and from the actual implementation of those tariffs. You see, there's three dimensions to this. The media picks up the threats and even the announcements and says, oh, trade war, trade war. But what really matters is what tariffs have been actually implemented. And as I said last week, if you look at actual implementations, there's $34 billion of U.S. tariffs imposed on Chinese exports to the U.S., U.S. imports from China, $34 billion. China has responded with its tit-for-tat $34 billion. There's a couple billion more that Trump imposed on solar panels and steel, although very little steel comes from China, ditto for aluminum. China, tit-for-tat, couple billion. So there's about like $36, $37 billion in match tariffs between China and the U.S. Well, what's the tariff picture with NAFTA? Far less. The U.S. Has imposed steel and aluminum tariffs, but it suspended those on Mexico, which is one of the larger steel importers to the U.S., Mexico has responded with $3 billion in kind. I mean, the total trade between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico is $1.1 trillion. And what we got is a few billion dollars, tit for tat, between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. It's nothing. $1.1 trillion total trade, exports, imports, and NAFTA. And we got maybe $3 to $5 billion U.S. tariffs, Mexican tariffs, Canadian tariffs a little bit more because Canada provides 40% of all aluminum to the U.S., maybe about $12 billion. So, you know, we got like $15, $18 billion total out of $1.1 trillion. Is this a trade war? Well, it's not even a tariff war, let alone a trade war, because a trade war is more than just tariffs, you see. When there's a bona fide trade war going on, there's non-tariff measures being taken, you know, administrative measures, barriers to trade, and so forth, not just tariffs. And more importantly, a bona fide trade war involves currency devaluations, exchange rate measures. That's a trade war. And we don't have that yet, although we're getting perilously close to it. I'll talk about that when we talk about China. All right, so there's no real trade war going on right now. There's threats of it, and the media picks it up and hypes it. You know, Trump comes out and says, oh, okay, China, you did a tit-for-tat match our $34 billion tariffs on your goods. You impose $34 billion. Oh, I'm going to impose $200 billion on you, China. $200 billion more tariffs I'm thinking about. And then he even says, how dare you, China? $500 billion. Let's just keep upping the ante. Well, it's all puffery. It's all threats. It's all Trump bombast, hyperbole. And it's not real. Okay, that's why, you know, the stock market and U.S. business is not really all that concerned yet, although there are signs that they're getting concerned. You know, there's $3.06 trillion of imports that come into the U.S. every year. $3 trillion. The U.S. has imposed tariffs, steel, aluminum, China, NAFTA, what, $70 billion out of $3 trillion? Ditto exports from the U.S. The response of our trading partners on the $2.58 trillion of U.S. exports they buy right? 3 trillion of imports, 2.58 trillion of exports, is about the same. It comes to 2.3% of all U.S. exports, and 2.3% of all U.S. imports actually have tariffs as a result of this tariff trade war that began last March. It's minuscule. It's not yet a trade war. It's not even a tariff war. Okay, in the midst of all this, what do we got? We have a stalling of negotiations with China, trade negotiations, all right? There was a flurry of activity last April, May. There was a deal that was almost reached. Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, ran over to Beijing there, and Beijing said, oh, okay, Steve, you bankers want more access to financing in our China market? We'll give it to you. He loved that. He's a banker. He's from Goldman Sachs. Right? U.S. multinational companies loved it too. China said, look, you guys can have 51% ownership before it was 49. We'll even give you 100%. Big concession by China. Mnuchin thought he had a deal, came back to Washington, and Trump said, no, not yet. What's that all about? And then the other major concession by China was it publicly said it would purchase $100 billion more every year of U.S. agricultural products. Well, that's very enticing to agribusiness and the farm bloc in the U.S. $100 billion more in sales every year from China? Well, China's very clever. China is dangling out these two plums, you know, market access for U.S. multinationals, and we're going to buy more agricultural goods. But China won't bend on the third demand of the United States, and that's technology transfer. That's where we got a hang up in China-U.S. negotiations. And we got a hang up because the faction in the U.S., in the defense lobby, and the Pentagon and intelligence agencies, they want to stop this tech transfer. They're worried because China has a policy called China 2025 where it wants to excel in the next generation technologies, 5G wireless, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence will not only be the industries of the future, but have tremendous military capabilities. So the Pentagon is worried that China, if it takes the lead in these next-gen technologies, will militarily leap over the U.S. That's what's holding up negotiations. The three main demands of the U.S., two of them are being met by China, but the third is not. So negotiations are stalled, and Trump is getting nervous. So Trump is now turning to the other trade fires he lit, and that's with NAFTA and with the EU. Well, with NAFTA, $1.1 trillion of trade with the U.S., we had a deal with NAFTA back in May, but Trump scuttled it. Trump didn't want a deal in May. He'll want a deal before the end of the year, and he can get a deal anytime he wants with Mexico and Canada. You see, all the real issues have been resolved except two that Trump threw into the pot here that are preventing a solution. One is adjudication of disputes by Mexico and or Canada against U.S. corporations. He doesn't want the ability to take U.S. corporations to court when they violate any agreement or laws in those countries, Mexico, Canada. The other major issue is Trump has insisted that every 5 years, the NAFTA agreement sunset terminates and therefore has to be renegotiated. Well, those are two issues that can be resolved fairly quickly, and Trump will resolve them when it's domestically, politically to his advantage. You see, because a lot of this has to do with domestic politics in the U.S. and the November midterm elections and his economic nationalism theme. He will come to token agreements with NAFTA and Europe, and all except China. And these token agreements will then be exaggerated misrepresented, blown out of proportion, so Trump can say to his political base, hey, look what I did, right? I really bashed these foreigners, right? We got a good deal. Well, it won't be such a good deal, but he'll say it is, and they'll believe him, and the media will repeat it. That's the domestic politics of all this. Right? He's mobilizing his base. He's agitating his base. I think it also has something to do with the Mueller indictment that'll come down here. You know, he wants to agitate that base so the chicken Republicans in Congress don't go after him, don't join the Democrats and go after him when it's found when they find out all of his shady dealings with Russian oligarchs and his shady taxes and his shady investments, you know, with Deutsche Bank and so forth. I think that all of this is going to be very clear once the Mueller indictment comes down, and we'll see. Well, this economic nationalism theme is all about agitating his base. You see, that's an advantage he's got with this theme, and he's playing it because it worked very well for him during the 2016 election, and it's going to work again, and it is working again. Okay, so that takes us to the recent this week deal with the EU. Well, typical to his form, what Trump did was come out with an exaggerated threat against the European Union. He said, look, you know, you guys, I'm going to slap 25% tariffs on European auto part imports to the U.S. We're talking about not European autos, we're talking about European auto parts. Because European auto companies, particularly German here, we're talking about, Germany depends heavily on its autos, have to import, in other words, ship to the U.S. a lot of the auto part for the German auto factories that assemble German cars in the U.S. I'm talking about BMW and Mercedes and Volkswagen. They all have plants in the U.S., you see, but they import a lot of the parts for the final assembly. Well, the U.S. auto companies are the same thing. You know, the GMs and even more so the Chryslers and Fords, they produce a lot of the parts in their autos worldwide, and then they import them back into the U.S. That's the model for the auto industry. Okay, so Trump said we're going to impose 25% on tariffs on auto parts. The U.S. already has a 25% tariff on trucks. You see, in trucks, small trucks and so forth are, you know, the big profit center for U.S. Auto assembly companies, right? Trucks. So there's a big U.S. tariff on truck imports. Not just on European truck imports, but also on Asian truck imports, you know, on the Toyotas and the Nissans and so forth, and, you know, whatever made in Korea and so forth. 25%. We have big tariffs already on trucks. Well, you know, he's saying we're going to extend it to autos, to the Europeans. Well, the Europeans get all upset. Oh, no, we can't do this. So they respond to the Trump threats by sending Juncker over, Jean-Claude Juncker, president of the European Parliament or the European Commission, I forget which one. He comes over and he strikes the deal, and they make a big hoopla about this, this deal. And what is the deal, right? Well, the deal is that Trump will back off of his threat of imposing 25% tariffs on European auto imports, part imports. Okay, so Trump has backed off on that. The two parties then agree to suspend as well the 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum and talk about negotiating that. Just talk. The EU gets a concession from Trump that they won't go ahead, the U.S. won't go ahead with tariffs on autos, and They the EU and the US will discuss other industrial tariffs. Discuss. They'll address. They'll discuss. That's all. Mm-hmm. The EU then dangled a couple bribes in front of Trump to get him to back off of his threat. And what were these bribes? One, the EU will proceed as quickly as possible to buy U.S. soybeans. Yeah, because China has stopped buying U.S. soybeans and it's causing big stress in Trump's base in the Midwest, soybean farmers. You know, that's why Trump comes and says this past week also, we're going to have a $12 billion special purchase of soybeans from U.S. farmers, you see, to make up for the loss from China, right? $12 billion. Well, they've lost more than $12 billion already. You know, $12 billion is a drop in a bucket for the losses for soybean farmers and pork farmers and corn and wheat farmers. You know, this is all because of China has responded to the U.S. and said, we're not going to buy this stuff now. And in other words, a targeted move against Trump because of the trade negotiations going on both sides, U.S. and China, which is stalled now. So Europe says, oh, we'll buy some soybeans from you, too, as quickly as we can proceed to do so. And also, we'll talk to you about buying more natural gas from the U.S. You see, the U.S. has an excess of natural gas production because of all this fracking going on. And the U.S. has wanted to sell this excess of natural gas to Europe ever since 2015. Now, the problem is it's much cheaper and easier for Germany and industrial Europe to get natural gas from Russia. But the U.S. wants to sell and wants to force Europe, particularly Germany, to buy the more expensive U.S. natural gas. And this is a part of the sanctions thing going on between the U.S. and Russia, right? Put sanctions on Russia and force Germany and others to buy U.S. natural gas. And stop this pipeline that's being built between Russia and Germany, this natural gas pipeline. Now, that's what sanctions are about, right? It's all about the U.S. oil companies and energy companies wanting to sell more natural gas to Europe. Okay, so Juncker says, we'll do that. We'll buy more natural gas from you, and we'll buy more soybeans right away. So think about it. Trump gets these major bribes and concessions from the EU, chicken EU, right? To buy more soybeans and buy more natural gas. And how does he do it? Simply because he threatened them, that's all. So he's not making the concession. He's just backing off from threats. And the Europeans are falling into his trap, saying, we will actually purchase more from you if you just don't slap theoretical tariffs on us. Well, that's certainly going to confirm for Trump that his whole strategy and his approach to these trade negotiations is working, right? Threaten your opponents and they'll cave in and give you something real, and all you have to do is back off of your threats. Okay? So his threat's getting results with the Europeans, and they're getting results with Mexico. Mexico, by the way, has sent its negotiators this past week to Washington quietly as well. The new president there, López Obrador, and they're exploring concessions, and they're going to come to a deal with Mexico. So what we got is Trump looking like his get-tough approach succeeds with Europe, and his get-tough approach will soon appear to succeed with Mexico, you know, and he'll be able to tout his economic nationalism and his tariff threat approach is working to his political base. Of course, it's not working with China, because what the U.S. wants from China is something quite different than what it said it wants from its other trading partners, Europe, major trading blocks, Europe and NAFTA. It wants technology transfer stopped, you see. That's the big crux of the problem and the dispute between the U.S. and China. Okay, so that's my analysis of the latest up-to-date moves and maneuvers here in the so-called trade war, which is not a trade war. It's a lot of smoke and mirrors. If it becomes a trade war, it will become a trade war with China. And we will soon see resolutions to, quote, the trade wars with Europe and NAFTA here, because that's being driven by domestic political politics and the November elections and the Mueller indictment and Trump mobilizing his domestic political base. Okay, so let's now talk about U.S. GDP. Okay, so second quarter GDP growth a whopping 4.1%. Of course, a lot of that is because the first quarter, the winter quarter, was so low, right? I forget exactly, but I think it was not much more than 1%, if that. Well, you know, the U.S. has a problem with its winter statistics. It always has very low growth in statistics in the winter quarter, which are then offset by excessively larger growth figures for the summer. This has been going on for several years now. There's something fundamentally wrong with the seasonality adjustments. Okay, so part of this 4.1 second quarter is making up for the underestimate of the first quarter. However, the third quarter looks like, you know, focuses, all predictions are, you know, come in around 3%. And the average for this year will be 3%, which is much, much higher than under Obama. You know, barely like 1.7, 1.8, if that, at times, averaging a GDP under Obama. So what's behind 3% this year, and will the forces that are driving 3% GDP in the U.S. this year disappear next year? I've been arguing that, yes, they will, that we're headed for mid to late 2019. We are headed for a recession in the U.S., okay? But let's talk about why we have this short-term growth in GDP in the U.S. Above the historical average of recent years. Okay. Well, if you look at GDP, there's four main sectors that economists always consider. You know, one is consumer spending, household spending, which is about 70% of GDP. Investment, business investment, which breaks down into investment in structures and buildings, investment in equipment, and investment in inventories. Okay, consumer spending breaks down into durables, non-durable goods, and services. Well, as I said, consumption, household, durable, non-durable, services, about 70% of GDP, and business fluctuates widely. It can go down to 3 or 4% of GDP, sometimes even negative during the Great Recession. When it's booming, it's around 10-12%, you know, which is roughly where it is here last year, this year. Okay. And business investment breaks down into structures, building structures. You know, when I say building structures, business building structures, I mean building factories and office buildings and hotels and, you know, resorts and things. That's all commercial real estate expansion. Mm-hmm. And housing is really part of consumption, residential housing. You know, building and structures and plant and equipment and inventories. Those are the main elements of investment. Okay, so let's look at, and that's about 10-12%. Government spending, roughly it's between 18-22% of GDP, and what's called net exports. The difference between imports and exports is usually negative because we import more than we export. So that usually subtracts from total GDP. Although if exports are rising and imports declining, which is the case recently, that can add from year to year, the change can add to GDP, or more properly stated, reduce the negative impact to GDP. Okay, so we got those four areas, right? So let's look at each one. The price, rising prices is boosting investment contribution to GDP. If prices are rising, businesses tend to invest more. Especially if prices are rising significantly, businesses want to invest quickly before the price of resources and inputs for production rise higher. In other words, they want to get the lower cost of the resources and the intermediate goods, whatever. So rising prices tend to stimulate investment as businesses accelerate their purchases of materials and intermediate goods. Okay, so yes, prices are rising, but prices are rising largely because of global oil and energy prices. And so why are global oil and energy prices rising? In other words, it's driving up the producer price index and personal consumption expenditures index, even the CPI price index in the U.S. All these are rising, but largely because of rising oil prices, which impacts all kinds of goods and services, right? So why are oil prices rising in turn? Well, that's because of speculators driving up the price of global crude oil. You see, oil is not just a commodity, it's a financial asset, it's a financial security that's traded in global markets, and speculators buy and sell these futures contracts on oil, and that drives up the price of oil. You see, it's not because there's more supply or more demand, that's more of a long-term effect, but you see these short-term significant fluctuations in the price of crude oil, well, that's global speculators who are driving up the price of oil. Well, that's been going on and driving up the global price of oil and therefore the cost of oil and energy and for businesses and consumers. And businesses, because the prices are going up, increase their purchases of real goods and services to get a jump on the rising inflation. And that's what's going on, why we're getting a little boost in investment here. It's not the tax cuts. That's not resulting in real investment that I'm talking about. That's resulting in financial stock bond derivatives spending. But the rising oil prices are stimulating real investment. And that's true for general business, as I described, but it's especially true for the energy companies themselves, you see, because the big boost in investment is coming from the oil companies and mining companies as they're increasing their output. So the rise in business investment boosting GDP is coming largely from the oil price hikes in the mining and oil and energy companies. And secondarily, from general price increases stimulating general business investment. Okay. There's also another price effect here, and that is all these price indexes in the U.S. underestimate the true magnitude of inflation. You know, whether you talk about the personal consumption expenditures price index or the consumer price index or the PPI, they all underestimate inflation. Inflation is actually higher. You know, officially the PCE is 2.3% over the past year, and the CPI is 2.9% over the past year. It's actually higher. Now, the point I want to make is that if you underestimate actual inflation, which is going on, you are boosting real GDP estimates. Because when you hear about GDP growth of 3%, 4%, whatever, it's adjusted for inflation. So if the inflation adjustment is low, then the real GDP number is higher. If inflation were truly represented accurately, as more than it has been, then the real GDP number, 3%, would actually be lower. So we got two price effects here contributing to a higher GDP than actually is the case. All right, both the general price rise, oil price, and so forth, and the lack of full adjustment of inflation for real GDP estimates. Okay, thirdly, the investment is rising. Business investment contribution GDP is rising, you know, at the 10-12% rate it is now because of trade war uncertainty. What you got going on is companies are buying up more raw materials, intermediate goods, increasing inventories from their foreign sources because of the trade war uncertainty. They're not sure whether the trade war will cause these things to be significantly higher if tariffs are really imposed throughout. So they're purchasing this stuff up front before. In other words, the trade war uncertainty, Trump's tariffs, are causing psychological uncertainty and forcing businesses to expand their investment, their purchases of materials faster than they ordinarily would. Well, that boosts investment contribution to GDP as well. Okay, so the tariff, the threat of tariffs, are also raising prices, like in steel. Steel prices are rising in the U.S., aluminum prices rising in the U.S., which gets transferred to all these companies making products with aluminum and steel. So the trade factor here is boosting GDP through the investment contribution to GDP, just as the price rises, prices rising are doing the same. All right, these are temporary developments, you see. They could reverse quite quickly. All right, so what about consumption? What's going on? Why are we getting more consumption? Household spending, in other words. Right. First quarter, it was like a 0.5% increase in consumption. Second quarter, 4%. Okay, why? What's going on? Well, it's certainly not because households have more real wage income. No. As we've said at other shows and written about it, wages, real wages are declining, especially as inflation accelerates and declining even faster. Why is consumption rising? Because of two things. One, in order to cover the rising cost of goods and services, households are reducing their savings rate. They're pulling money out of their savings in order to maintain their standard of living and purchases. So the savings rate decline is translating into a consumption increase. Also, secondly, they're borrowing a hell of a lot more in order to maintain their consumption levels. As we said before in other shows, $20 trillion more increase in household debt since 2007. Okay, so it's debt-based, it's savings reduction-based, driving this. The savings rate has declined to about 3% here. Historically, it's been, you know, between 5 and 10% in the U.S. and sometimes even more. But here's an interesting aside. The 3% real savings rate collapse, the 3%, has recently been statistically assumed away. The government has revised the way it estimates the savings rate so that overnight, the 3% becomes 7.2%. You see, the government does this all the time. If it doesn't like the statistics, the data, it redefines it and wipes it away. That's why you got to be suspect of a lot of government data and statistics that gets revised. Right? We recently had a show here on precarious jobs a few months ago, and I'll be writing about that more, in which I showed how the government conveniently redefined the way the huge number of precarious jobs, part-time, temp, on-call, gig, etc., redefined it away so it looks like we have no additions to really gig and precarious temp employment since 2005, you see. Well, go back and listen to that show or read the forthcoming piece I have on how the government has defined away the problem of part-time temp jobs, which are always lower paid and no benefits. They revise their statistics from time to time. So you got to be, a little mistrusting of some of this. Here's another one that they just revised. Corporate profits. We know corporate profits have been going through the roof in recent years. Well, they redefined this to reduce the level of corporate profits as well. They just did this, by the way. Redefined the savings rate, redefined corporate profits. You know, I debate with my Marxist economist friends who believe corporate profits are driving everything. Rising corporate profits, drive investment. And when corporate profits don't increase at an increasing rate, it slows investments and brings on recessions. Well, that's like a mid-19th century simplistic view of capitalist finance in the 21st century. Well, I debate with them. And, one of my arguments is that, look, what do you mean by corporate profits? They're manipulated. The definitions are so different across countries, and there's so many different definitions of profits. And by the way, only 20%, one-fifth of all business investment is driven by internal earnings and profits. The rest is borrowed or issued in corporate bonds or in these credit markets, capital markets, So profits don't drive investment. There's really forces that are new to the 21st century that drive investment. And that's why a lot of investment, by the way, is flowing into financial asset markets. Okay, so enough on that aside. Let's get back to consumption. And summarize here. We have an increase in consumption. We have an increased investment that's boosting GDP this year, but the consumption is not driven by real income. It's driven by debt and savings rate reductions. It's driven by increasing inflation and the debt and credit cards. Hello? And student and autos. Autos and everything is rising. So we have this problem of compensation for inflation and other forces, increasing debt and consumption from savings reduction. Okay, and then on the business side, we have inflation and the threat of trade disruptions, which is driving investment. Government spending contribution to GDP is also rising because Trump has increased defense spending by $100 billion. Every year for the last 2 years. And more is coming, by the way. More is coming. That $100 billion was for 2 years. And we're going to see in the next budget of Trump even more war defense spending. All right. Trade contribution, the net deficit is actually declining. The trade deficit is declining because the U.S., is reducing its imports, and foreigners are purchasing more U.S. agricultural goods in anticipation of the tariffs. You see the opposite effect that we were talking about. Yeah, soybeans and so forth. There was a big boost in soybean sales purchases by foreigners, building up stocks in anticipation of a trade conflict. All right, so all of those four areas are sort of in sync, causing a temporary rise in U.S. GDP. And that's why next we're going to see something like 3.5% to 4% here right before the midterm elections. And boy, is Trump going to trumpet that. Yeah. Well, look at the growth rate here, you know. Politicians always do this right before elections anyway. But there are big problems in the U.S. Economy continuing afterwards in 2019. The biggest problem is the continued federal rate hikes, interest rate hikes. We've got probably two more coming this year, and next year they say four more. Well, we're already at 2% federal funds rate. And as I've been saying on this show repeatedly, you cannot get the Fed funds rate up much above 2.5%. In other words, another two, maybe three hikes without causing a credit contraction, which will lead to a recession in the U.S. Well, that's my argument. Already, you've got, 10-year Treasury bond rates, which follow, and two-year Treasury notes. I think Treasury notes are like 2.5%, and 10 years at 10. Almost at 3%. Can't go too much higher here without severe impact on the stock markets, on other markets, and on household spending. We're already seeing the hikes in mortgage rates and auto loan rates having a slowing effect on those two important sectors of the U.S. economy. Small, medium business, bank loan rates are rising, education loan rising, housing sales, new and existing homes are slowing. Autos, of course, are slowing. Inflation is rising in terms of rents and health insurance and gas prices for most median households here, big factors. All this is going to slow consumption and investment next year. We already see commercial real estate, which is in a bubble, collapsing. In other words, growth is stagnating with prices at bubble levels, which means is we're not too far from a major deflation of commercial real estate prices. And even soon after, housing real estate prices, although a shortage of housing growth here in the U.S. construction is keeping those prices up a little higher, a little bit longer. So there's some real problems in the U.S. economy that I think are going to cause the economy to reverse this 3+% GDP this year and next year. We're going to see something more negative. Okay, which brings us nicely to our current debate that's ongoing about the Federal Reserve raising its rates. Trump even came out with a warning against the Fed, the central bank, saying, raising these rates is not such a good idea, which was kind of breaking with tradition. The president does not challenge the Fed, our elected officials here have no influence over appointed officials who run the monetary system of this country. From the very beginning, the Federal Reserve was a bank for the bankers. That's its whole function, to bail out the banks when they get in trouble by printing money electronically or whatever, right? Bail them out so the politicians don't have to take the heat and bail them out. That's the purpose of a central bank, always has been. I examine this, the functions of the central banking, including lender last resort and money supply management and phony bank supervision, in great detail in my book last year, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression. Now we got a real debate of that going on. And Trump is... crossed the line and actually warned, didn't really threaten. You don't threaten the big bankers of this country, even if you're president. And warned you know, this may be going too far. You may, you guy, I'm doing all this work with all these big tax cuts for my business friends and taking on their trade opponents and trading partners on their behalf, renegotiating better deals, free trade deals for them. And now you, Federal Reserve, you're raising your rates. You know, you're going to ruin the whole show. Well, that was Trump's warning. But it's kind of ironic, you see. Why is the Fed raising rates? Well, it's not because of inflation. No. In fact, inflation's around 2%, and the Fed, therefore, should back off raising rates if inflation were the real target for Fed policy, which it isn't. As I show in my book, it's been phony. The 2% federal inflation rate as a target for the Fed, Fed policies is phony. It's always been phony. Why is the Fed raising rates now? No, not because of inflation. It's raising rates because it has to somehow attract investors to buy treasury bonds and bills and notes in order to finance Trump's trillion-dollar annual budget deficits. That's what it's all about. He's got to attract more money, especially since the trade war may cause, you know, China and Japan and others to slow their purchases of bonds. Well, you got to raise the, you know, the offering, your yield, your interest rate on the bonds to get more people to buy them in the U.S. and globally. And half of the deficits being is bought now. Half of the national debt is owed to foreigners, right? Not just U.S. sources, 48%, something like that. Okay, so you got to raise rates. If you got $1 trillion, you got to sell $1 trillion worth of bonds and bills in order to cover the $1 trillion deficit. Well, why do you got the deficit? Well, you got a deficit because you cut taxes on investors and businesses to almost nil. Trump's, as I've said, $5 trillion tax cut to businesses and investors, net $3 trillion, okay, is the major cause, as well as war and defense spending $100 billion more a year, is the major cause of the deficits that we've got. Well, the Fed has to raise rates. So Trump is really criticizing himself. He's caused the deficit increases, the $1 trillion annual for the next decade to come. He's caused them. And now he criticizes the Fed for raising rates to pay for them. Go figure. Yeah, so kind of ironic. Now, the irony is really double, because when you raise interest rates, that drives up the value of the dollar. You see, the foreigners have to buy more dollars with their currency in order to buy treasury bonds. And that demand for dollars rises, okay, in response to the higher interest rates that they want to buy. Okay, so it drives up the value of the dollar. The Fed raising interest rates drives up the value of the dollar. Now, when you raise the value of the dollar, you drive down the value of other currencies. So, ironically, Trump is causing the devaluation of the Chinese yuan and other currencies around the world. Because the dollar's rising, because interest rates are rising, because higher interest rates are necessary to fund his $1 trillion deficits caused by his tax cuts and more spending. It's all interrelated, you see. All these economic forces are interrelated. So the irony of all ironies is Trump is raising tariffs, but causing devaluations of currency exchange rates that will offset his increase in tariffs. Trump says simplistically, I don't think the guy really understands all this. You know, he's not that bright. He's very clever and he's a street fighter, but he's not that bright. He knows how to intimidate people to get a deal, but he doesn't really understand the ramifications of all these policies. So, you know, he's pushing his trade wars, his tariffs, and he's causing devaluations around the world. And then he goes and he complains about China devaluing its currency. Well, China's doing everything it can right now to keep its currency from being devalued further. It's at the end of its band, that's 6.8.9 to the dollar. And should it break through that band, which will happen, it will set off competitive devaluations around the world. Now you got a true trade war because the tariffs are precipitating a currency war. That's coming should Trump continue with his aggressive trade policies. Well, I don't think he's continuing. You see, I think he's backing off. We'll see that very clearly, you know, with Europe and NAFTA, which leaves the real trade war with China. You know, will the rising rates and dollar drive China currency devaluation out of its ban that will then spill over contagion effect to all the other emerging market economies and cause a global currency war? Already you got countries like Turkey, 33% decline in its currency, Argentina, Brazil, other Indonesia, now India. All these currencies are weakening rapidly. And in Europe, the European Central Bank decides, well, we're not going to raise rates. You know, why? Because your currency is already devaluing against the dollar because of U.S. policies. See, it's the U.S. that's doing this. Well, this mainstream economist named Martin Feldstein, who's well-connected with business and capitalists in the U.S., has come out in the Wall Street Journal recently with an interesting editorial argument saying, well, the Fed needs to raise rates. The Fed needs to raise the federal funds rate to 4% because the Fed needs to get a cushion for the next recession that's coming so that it could then cut rates to stimulate the economy. So Feldstein says it should go to 4%, the federal funds rate, which means you're going to have bond rates at 5%. I'm saying it'll never get that far. The capital markets will crash before that, just as they did in 2007. You see, the federal funds rate was raised to 5.25%, and that precipitated, didn't cause, precipitated the banking crash. Well, Feldstein's saying, well, we got to do it again because the asset bubbles in stocks and bonds, where he says correctly, the stock prices are now 50% above their historical average. 50%, that's a bubble. And commercial real estate is way above its historical average. Well, these are bubbles, and they're going to collapse, he says, so you might as well prepare and raise interest rates. By the way, he said if the bubbles collapse, it will wipe out $9 trillion in household assets. $9 trillion. And will have an effect of cutting consumer spending 2% off of GDP. Well, you know, what he's saying is we're going to have a recession soon, so we might as well raise interest rates to have a cushion to lower interest rates, because the asset bubbles are going to collapse anyway. So let's go ahead and do it. Well, on the liberal side, this guy, Kocher Lakota, ex-former Fed governor, argues that there's no need to raise interest rates anymore because, you know, the core inflation rate's only 1.9% and 2% is the Fed target. Well, the problem with that view is that, as I said, inflation is never the target of the Fed. Okay, so that's the debate among myopic mainstream economists on Fed funds rates. Okay, next week, I'm sure Trump will give us more to talk about.